What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hi, before you skip ahead, hang out for a second. One of the most important things to me is consistently being here for you. Now that I say that out loud, it sounds super codependent. But you know, it's true. We seldom miss shows or take unexpected breaks because we know how rare it is to be included in your daily routine. So if you like this podcast, the best way to help us maintain this level of consistency is to subscribe to the Patreon page at patreon.com/Bob Seska Show. And being a supporter has its own perks, too, like the Shadow Docket bonus show every Tuesday and Thursday, plus the Friday after party with me and Kimberly, and the commercial-free Ultimate Edition versions of the main shows. Just go to patreon.com/Bob Seska Show, click on the box for the level that you can afford, and you're all set. Thanks so much for supporting our Patreon page, and now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Bob.
Bob.
Bob. Maluga, luga, 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 luga.
Why don't I just call you Bob?
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, April 10, 2024, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 1,177 of the Biden-Harris administration, 209 days until the 24th presidential election. You can find me on Threads and Instagram at TheBobSeska, Twitter, BobSeska_go, and our Patreon page is BobSeskaShow.com. So back when she was a Republican consultant, Sherry Jacobus was put through 9 levels of hell by Trump and his goons. And today, she's providing unique insights into the MAGA movement that only a former Republican and never-Trumper can bring to the table. On top of all that, she's been sounding the alarm on the alleged slowness of the investigations into Trump, a topic we're definitely going to talk about today, along with her analysis of the janky polling, what may have happened all the way back in 2016, the Republican position on abortion, and so much more. So don't nobody move, okay? Meantime, don't forget to support this podcast by subscribing to us at patreon.com/Bob Seska Show. Okay, here's me catching up with the great Sherry Jacobus.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
So how are you holding up? That's my first big question for you, because here we are with Donald Trump on the ballot getting way too much support and way too much leeway from the political press. So how are you coping?
You know, I do have to step away from it every now and again.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
a bit much.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I get more used to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then other times when I get, you know, it's a little triggering for me. You have to remember he came after me hard.
Yeah.
Starting in 2015. And I see a lot of people who did a lot of bad things sort of take advantage of the whole situation with him mm-hmm. and make great careers out of suddenly seeing the light.
Yeah.
I see Michael Cohen out there who, you know, I have knowledge of stuff that he's done that he's not been held accountable for.
Mm-hmm.
It's just become a bit of a circus.
Yeah,
I'd like to say I'm over it because for me personally, if Trump spends the rest of his life in prison, it makes no difference. He did so much damage.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, yeah. Because you can't repair that damage. It's going to be decades before that damage gets repaired. And I hate to start out with such doom and gloom, but that's the reality. If Donald Trump were to disappear tomorrow, that'd still be the case, right?
Right. And so many of the little people, of which I am one, were harmed irreparably.
Yeah.
Some of the bigger names that had big support and got the good legal help and all that, they did okay. But for the most part, when Donald Trump and his goons decide that someone is to be ruined and disappeared, mm-hmm. they're disappeared right. and they are ruined. And, you know, thoughts and prayers don't help. So he successfully has done that to people his entire life. He's still doing it. He's still not in prison.
Yeah.
the media is still gorging on those Trump ratings. We saw Ari Melber last night have Michael Abinanti on.
Yeah. What
and,
the hell?
Who appears to be angling for a Trump pardon. So it's like the more things change, the more they stay the same. We, as you said, we are right back in this place, or we're still in this place.
For the folks who don't know your backstory, as far as what you mentioned regarding 2015 and Donald Trump, just walk us through that briefly. What kind of
briefly?
Yeah. What kind of meat grinder he put you through because right. you wouldn't genuflect to that form of the Republican Party?
Right. I was a longtime Republican operative, lived yeah. in D.C. for 30 years, RNC spokesperson. I was always one of those rhinos.
Yeah.
Worked in leadership, ran campaigns, started doing that at a time when women weren't doing it, but I didn't get the memo. So I had made this my life, my career, mm-hmm. and I was a longtime TV pundit. I was on all three of the cable nets a couple thousand times.
Oh, yeah.
So when the campaigns start heating up, I'm one of the people that the presidential campaigns would start reaching out to see if I want to, you know, some folks reached out to me from Carly Fiorina's campaign, blah, blah, blah. An old friend asked me if I would, he said he was going to be working on the Trump super PAC, and he was with the exploratory committee, and he was in New York, and that they really needed a communications director. And I was like, well, yeah, you know, so I agreed to, I said, well, why don't we sit down and talk about it? I agreed to have lunch because I was a consultant. You don't just not talk to people. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, sure.
But I had a feeling that he was going to ask. So that's why I was real cagey with my response, because I wanted to be polite and say no. And he brings along a guy that I'd never met, never heard of before, named Corey Lewandowski. And they worked
wow.
on me. And it took 3 weeks for them to talk me into seeing them again, but I agreed to. And this time, you know, I go down on Fifth Avenue, call my mom. I'm like, oh God, this guy's terrible. She says, well, don't burn your bridge with your pal.
Yeah.
Long story short, I didn't like Lewandowski. I thought he was a complete ass. Can I say ass on your show?
Absolutely. You can say whatever the hell you want.
Yeah. He was pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, my friend says, oh, Corey, I really liked you, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you know, I waited a couple days, and then I sent the email saying, gee, Jim, thanks so much for thinking of me, but this isn't for me. Didn't really appreciate the hazing by Lewandowski, but you mm-hmm. have a great time working on that super PAC.
Yeah.
Well, you never made it to the super PAC. Trump goes on, becomes an asshole, as we saw, well, always has been.
Mm-hmm.
I make my first public statements against him on the John McCain stuff. A couple months later, there was articles coming out in the Washington Post outlining the super PAC that Trump had, that he was claiming he was self-funding, but he wasn't, blah, blah, blah. They say the Washington Post is lying. They're going to sue them. Lewandowski's slamming the phone. I step forward and say, oh, no, they had a super PAC, told me all about it, talked mm-hmm. about it openly in front of me.
Yeah.
That's when the trouble started with me. I was started the catfishing of me that day. They had somebody pretend to be a lawyer representing big Republican contributors that wanted to hire me to help defeat Trump, blah, blah, blah. I kind of figured it out. I go on, and I was banned from Fox. He immediately got me banned from Fox.
Jesus.
Immediately. Cut off after all those years. So it mm-hmm. was weird stuff. A few months later, I'm on CNN. We start talking about, is Trump self-funding? I bring it up again. That night, you know, Trump is defaming me, or he has Lewandowski call into Morning Joe the next day, claim I begged him for a job, got turned down, blah, blah, blah. So they do it again the next week when I'm on CNN, and, you know, Trump defames me on Twitter, and, you know, I can't defend myself against that.
Of course not.
And yeah. long story short, you know, I decided that I'm going to be filing a defamation suit, because I'm immediately kicked off of CNN, too. I'd mm-hmm. forgotten that Jeff Zucker was longtime buddies with Trump and had greenlit The Apprentice for
right.
him when he was head of entertainment at NBC. Mm-hmm. So during this time, some months go by, but they get the catfisher, but the person who did it, but they haven't tied it to Trump yet. You know, I'm dealing with Preet Bharara's office. Then I am hacked. When the story's coming out in Political about the catfishing, and they had to make the call, Political had to make the call to the Trump campaign before publishing. Between the time they made that call and the time that the piece came out a couple days later, I got hacked. So now there's an FBI investigation.
So what with the hacking, what exactly did they get into? Do they
everything? And yeah. what they were looking for was information they could use against me in court. I was terrified. I was threatened. I was told Trump was had people, guys in Queens, that were on their way over to get me one night, you know, needed a squad car in front of my house. It was terrifying. It
Good
was absolutely
God.
Terrifying. So when people act like, oh, people, this is all just baloney, what they're saying about Trump, I have firsthand experience, and it is terrifying. And Bob, I'd been involved in politics for decades, mm-hmm. And things could get pretty rough. This was different. This was a whole different animal, and I knew that it was real. And my dad is sick, so I'm hightailing out of town, but I'm suing him in New York, so I'm keeping an apartment. I'm sharing it with somebody else, kind of go back and forth. So what they were trying to find out was anything they could use against me, and it turns out what they were trying to do is find out if I was spending enough time in New York, so otherwise they could get a change of venue. Mm-hmm. So, because I was in Maryland a lot with my dad.
Yeah.
So they're doing that. There was actually three data points that happened later on. I don't want to make up this story any longer than it needs to be. But in short, the FBI was on this, and three data points showing that these guys had information from my hacked emails and were trying to use it, including J.D. Gordon, who he eventually was able to, once Trump won, he was able to go to his former boss and friend, the new AG, Jeff Sessions, mm-hmm. and have the investigation shut down because I thought they were close to indictment. So I am very well aware of what Trump does and what he can do to lawyers. And I'm very well aware that Michael Cohen, for example, was involved in some of this because there were some things that only he would have had the authority to do, such as hire Holland and Knight and give them their instructions to find out, you know, where I was spending my time and that sort of thing. So it's disheartening for me. And it used to be more upsetting than it is, but I'm becoming somewhat numb to it, although it is a little triggering at times. Some of these people that have become media stars and darlings, and they were in fact the criminals and done a lot of this stuff. We saw Michael Caputo become a little TV star and raise all this money. And we know, and he had access to my hacked emails and he did a lot of horrible things. We see it with Roger Stone. We see it, you know, Ari Melber, who, you know, I like, and I used to be on his show a lot, you know, but they pulled back because they, you know, when Trump decides you're done, mm-hmm. even with the good guys.
Yeah.
So to see Michael Avenatti, and still for me to see Michael Cohen, we don't see Caputo anymore, but he's back with the campaign. We see Paul Manafort reportedly going back to the campaign and Roger Stone and these people walking around free. And we still have this hope that it's all going to work out. Well, it hasn't, as our friend Glenn Kirshner always says, and well, it's not his saying, but he says it, justice delayed is justice denied.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of us, it really won't matter. When you're ruined, and people who could help, frankly, don't because they don't want to get blood splattered on them.
Yeah.
So that is the reality, and that's a lot of the so-called good guys in the game or what we think are the good guys. And when it drags on this long, Bob, there's a little cottage industry that builds up around this.
Uh-huh.
And you know, that's what I think is dangerous now because the media, for example, can't do without Trump. They need him. They want him.
Yeah.
And they are propping him up, normalizing him.
I'm so terribly sorry that this happened to you. It's absolutely horrendous. I mean, the stress alone.
It didn't happen. It was done.
It was
done
to you. Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. Well, that leads me to my next question, which is on a day when Alan Weisselberg has been sentenced to more prison time because, once again, he's there lying in court to defend Trump. Why do people still want to get close to this rat bastard, knowing that they will most likely get burned in the process, either legally or Donald Trump will throw them under a bus? Why do people feel, I guess, masochistic enough that they want to work with this guy? They want to be in on that inner circle with Donald Trump, knowing what could happen.
Well, for some of them, it was the most exciting time of their life. If the most high profile or lucrative thing that you've ever done in your life is to be associated with Donald Trump, first of all, how freaking sad for you.
Right.
You know, they miss the rush of it all. And I'll be honest, that's why I don't trust the whole Michael Cohen thing. When he goes on TV and gives his analysis of the psychological status of Trump, I don't think he really knows. I think he's just saying what's going to work for him on TV. I think we need to be very, very careful of these people. Even if you say, well, they pay their debt to society or anything, but be very careful of the people who were ever in Trump world. And I say that for people who worked in the administration, And then were big supporters of him. And then all of a sudden they see the light and they turn. Well, no, they always knew. Mm-hmm. None of these people were so stupid as to not know what Trump was. They were getting something from him. It was working for them. Or when it stopped working for them, or when they didn't get what they want, then all of a sudden they turn on him. Mm-hmm. And they get their book deals and their TV deals. And we look to them as trusted experts and political or legal analysts. And I don't think that we should be doing that. There were plenty of people who knew exactly what he was and were speaking out against him, regardless of if they had an R or a D after their name. And that's what I meant about this dragging on so long, where there's this cottage industry. And we have this entire new cast of characters who were never in media before, weren't in politics, and all of a sudden, here they are. And it wasn't like that at first. I think we've got some excellent legal analysts out there that they found to kind of walk us through some of this. But some of it's just showbiz.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Clicks, eyeballs.
Right. That's what's so distressing about this is, you know, there's that level of cynicism behind the scenes kind of driving the really shitty coverage. And I was glad to see Molly Jong-Fast calling out Jim Vandehei on MSNBC yesterday, which absolutely needs to be done. I hope the people at Axios have some level of shame that they can feel the weight of what Molly said to them on the air yesterday and maybe make some changes, though I'm not holding my breath for that, but I do have my fingers crossed. But I wanted to ask you, going back to what you were put through, what was done to you, that's not typical of the Republican Party pre-Trump, right? That was unique to the beginning of Trump's takeover of the party, right? That it was, even going back to Karl Rove, going back to as far back as Lee Atwater, it was never about retribution like that. It was always, you know, the strategy was always geared toward defeating Democrats, not necessarily punishing anyone who, like you, who doesn't go along with whoever, right?
Right. Well, little by little, we did see the party become less and less tolerant of people like me. When I first started working in politics on Capitol Hill, I was mainstream, very moderate, you know, and I mean, I worked for Bob Michael, for gosh sakes, and who he wouldn't be allowed in the party right now. So he was a House Republican leader. And then when Republicans took over the majority and Newt became Speaker, there was this sense of, why am I sitting at the table here in these leadership staff meetings with Ginny Thomas, you know? So there were things that were uncomfortable. Yeah. It just seemed inappropriate. And she and I were friendly. She seemed real nice and everything. But then, you know, you get a call saying someone's doing an article on her, and I call her. People thought we were friends just because we had to work together. And she was like, oh, here, you know, they're coming after me. And I'm thinking, then why are you doing this? It was just felt so inappropriate that she was a staff on House Majority Leader Dick Armey's staff, leadership staffer. And I didn't know that she had any sort of political, you know, formal political jobs before that. So she was in that job solely because she was married to a Supreme Court justice, to Clarence Thomas. Mm-hmm. And it was inappropriate. And I just didn't understand why she was doing this, particularly when she whined about it constantly, you know, but, oh, they're after me. It's like, well, then of course they are. Mm-hmm. Why are you here? You know? And so here we are all these years later, she should be in prison, and look at her.
Yeah. Sherry, I don't know if we talked about this last time you were on the show, but one of the things I'm most fascinated about in terms of this period of time, let's say the last 9 years or so, is I'm watching a lot of very partisan Republicans kind of seeing the light and making a shift in their personal values in this process of divorcing themselves from the GOP. What's that been like for you? I went through the same kind of thing. I founded the Young Republicans Club at my high school.
I did not know that.
Yeah, wow. I was raised Catholic.
I'm going to have to process this.
But I went through that whole transition where.
Does Kimberly know this?
Oh yeah, yeah. I've talked about it on my show as my face turns 9 shades of red every time I do, but. I remember that process where my values started to change, where I started to experience more of the world. I mean, I was a much younger man when this happened. But as far as your values, have they changed significantly along with your party affiliation? Or what has the process been like for you over these last 9 years or so?
You know, it's interesting. We used to have this secret group of Never Trumpers that would meet in Washington every 2 weeks. It was, you know, Bill Kristol and, wow. You know, people like that. And we go around the table and, mm-hmm. and we'd say, what have you changed on issues? Your mind, what has been the surprise that you changed on issues since all this happened?
Yeah.
And almost to a person, which issues, people went around the rooms and said, on guns.
Wow.
And yeah, so there are some issues. And I think I tweeted about this the other day. A lot of Republicans who left the party because of Trump, we've changed our stance on issues for a number of reasons. We no longer trust the people and the people and the institutions and the people in those institutions that we were working with when we thought as a nation we were probably all on the same page in terms of our goals,
yeah.
but maybe had different ways to get there. And I no longer trust any of those people. In fact, I left the party, Bob, the day after they nominated Trump. I didn't wait to see if he won. And people are like, oh, you know, we're all going to come together and he's going to lose. And then, you know, the party will come together again, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, if you are okay with this man being the nominee of your party, and even if you're just going through the motions because you're an operative and you want to maintain your position as a cog in the wheel, keep your TV contract, your column, your lobbying gigs, you know, whatever it is you're doing, your position on the Hill. If you're okay with that, even when they knew what was being done to me, then I can't sit at the table with you again in strategy meetings, at, you know, in any capacity like I had done for decades. I didn't trust the people.
Yeah.
I don't trust the motives. I don't trust the money behind it. So with that, and then we see it appears they didn't ever really believe what they said they believed anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way this happened, and I'm talking about the establishment Republicans. Remember, Trump was running as an anti-establishment Republican.
Right.
The establishment D.C. folks did not support Trump in the primary in 2015,
mm-hmm.
in early 2016. They simply didn't. And
right.
In fact, they were like, he's never going to win. This can't happen. What they failed to understand was, well, first of all, the Putin, what Putin could do.
Oh, yeah.
They failed to understand the hold that he had on these media executives based in New York, on Roger Ailes, Jeff Zucker. They thought that you run this stuff out of Washington, basically, that Washington was the center of the universe, which it should be in politics. And so you would think, well, then the political media follows that. Uh-uh. Media leads.
Mm-hmm.
Leads.
Yeah.
And so everybody was just taken aback that they were handing the networks over to them. And we had presidential candidates, 15, 16 of them on the Republican side that, you know, a lot of them had done TV. They were pretty sophisticated with media and politics. That's why they were running for president. in disbelief that they couldn't get on CNN without being asked about Trump. I had, at the time, Chris Cuomo had his morning show, and I was based in New York then. And after I did the morning show, he says, let's go, and I want to talk to you. And he took me out for breakfast. It was real, you know, this real early show.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to pick my brain about how he could beat Morning Joe. You know, he couldn't compete with Fox and Friends. And I said, and we were talking about the Trump stuff. So this would have been the summer of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're talking about John Kasich. He couldn't get John Kasich on the show. I'm like, what do you mean? I said, look, everybody knows in D.C., one of the most dangerous places to be in D.C. is between John Kasich and a TV camera.
I love that.
You know, they say that about Chuck Schumer, too.
Yeah.
If you can't get John Kasich, then there's something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about Rubio. And I said, every time you have these people on, you ask them about Trump. There are 15, 16 people in this primary. They go, what the hell are you doing? And he said, well, that's because he says yes and they don't. I said, he's going to say that's, you know, so he's more available. Since when does that matter?
Yeah.
You know, I said, you guys are doing this. And, you know, but it was the media, and that's all they cared about. Remember, the purpose of this breakfast, you know, buying me a plate of eggs was to pick my brain on how to beat Morning Joe. So they weren't interested in doing good political coverage.
Yeah.
But this was something that I think was lost on the D.C. establishment, and they were kind of caught flat-footed.
Yeah.
So they all kind of got in line, thinking, okay, we'll get through this. We'll have our convention. He'll lose in November, and then we go back to normal.
Well, mm-hmm. That worked out really well, huh?
Yeah.
And I'm wondering,
good plan.
Obviously, this is something that we've been discussing quite a bit on social media, on my show, and so forth. We've been sort of trying to figure out the motivation of the press and why there is this obvious attempt to kind of nudge Donald Trump back into office. We're not imagining things, are we, Sherry? I mean,
you're not imagining.
This
things.
Is really
we
happening.
Should know like, that by now.
Exactly. Well, they think this is good for business if they get Trump back into office, and so they're kind of hedging their own future as journalists in a sense, where they're kind of betting that if Trump comes back, well, maybe he won't arrest any of them as enemies of the people, right? Maybe that's the calculation. I don't know.
That's what they're thinking. And, you know, it's like that with some of the pundits, too, frankly. Mm-hmm. Some of the people who you never heard of as political operatives who now are these political experts.
Yeah.
And you need to be, I'm not saying across the board just discount them, but we need to be a little smarter now that we've been through a couple of cycles. And then you have some of these political journalists, Bob, that maybe were baby cub reporters or maybe started their careers at the beginning of the era of Trump. I mean, we've been in this now for 8 years.
Nine.
Are we eight?
Yeah. Nine. Almost, yeah, almost nine. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. So some of these people don't know any other way.
Right.
They don't know. I mean, they don't know how to do anything other than be stenographers or do the he said, she said, you know, they look out the, if one person says it's raining and the other person says it's dry, it's not your job to, as a journalist, to just say what they said, look out the freaking window and tell us what's going on.
Yeah.
And journalists don't do that anymore. And some people say, well, because it's the 24/7 news cycle and everything is so media. Well, yes and no. We also have a lot more media outlets than we used to in the old days. Mm-hmm. That competition is good, but it also means that we have a lot of people as quote journalists who really aren't. I kind of in some ways prefer the old days when there were fewer of them. It was more competitive and they had to really know what journalism was.
Yeah.
And now we don't have that. And it doesn't seem to hurt their careers. So, you know, for Jim Vandehei, I remember him before he was even with Politico, before he started Politico. I mean, he's done a lot of great work in journalism by creating these new outlets, but Axios is a little bit over the top. So I'm glad that he was publicly called out by Molly, and the look on his face.
I know.
He's like, are you seriously doing this to me?
He tried so hard to wiggle out of that, and it didn't quite work.
But think about it. What do some of these people do, these media personalities, be they pundits or journalists, hosts, whatever, what will they do if Trump loses and he goes off to prison and nobody's paying attention anymore to all of these court cases, because once he's dealt with in like, let's say he goes to prison next week is the Stormy Daniels trial. So let's say this happens, he goes to prison and he's done. And let's say he loses. Let's say that the Mike Pence's of the world turning against him actually makes a difference with just enough Republicans, which I think it will. I think that's more impactful than people are giving credit for.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's more persuadable voters out there, you know, Republicans, and people understand. Mike Madrid, you know, agrees with me. I have had him on my podcast, and so we've talked about that. So let's say Trump is done. What happens to some of these people?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
What do they do for a living?
Yeah.
Are they going to go out and run campaigns?
Right.
Some of us do.
They have to write about actual issues. Amazing how that would end up working. But you know what? I wanted to talk to you about this. It's kind of changing subjects a little bit. But you mentioned Donald Trump going to prison. So it's mea culpa time. I was one of those guys, Sherry, who's given Merrick Garland and the DOJ a fair amount of leeway in pursuing these criminal investigations against Trump. You, on the other hand, have been sounding the alarm about the delay for quite some time now. Turns out you've been kind of right about this. And so I wanted to give credit where credit is due, that you were calling the fact that we were going to end up against the 2024 election with these trials. So once again, congratulations. You kind of nailed it. How are you feeling
I don't feel good. I wish that more people had realized it, because even though he's not supposed to respond to public pressure, I think he does. We saw that he did respond to the January 6th committee. And at that time, we had Adam Schiff out there saying, hey, if you're waiting for us to act first, Mr. AG, don't. Yeah. That's not how this is supposed to go. And remember, Adam Schiff had worked at DOJ. He had been out maybe 7 years that time. But he had been talking to people on the inside. He said, there's nothing going on. Mm-hmm. So there were people who knew and knew something was up. And other people, again, part of the cottage industry or people who are pundits, you know, they want to please different sides, so they don't want to go out too far on that limb. And some just out of professional courtesy, I think is sort of the white man country club thing, but maybe just professional courtesy. You know, Lawrence Tribe, I mean, he it took him a long time because Merrick Garland had been his student. Harvard Law. In fact, Tribe even kind of came after me. And a few weeks ago, other people found those old tweets and said, Mary Tribe, you got something to say to Sherry Jacobus, an apology here? And that's not what I'm looking for. But it just comes from, again, I don't put on the rose-colored glasses. Maybe it's because for a living, I've done politics for a living and run campaigns and done strategy and even taught it political communication strategy at the master's level at GW for 4 years. So you sort of train yourself to be able to peer around corners and kind of put all the information together in front of you and see what makes sense, not just how it makes you feel. I think a lot of people early on, again, Lawrence Tribe and some of the others, professional courtesy, they were going to give Merrick Garland the benefit of the doubt. I don't think that was helpful. But, you know, when people say something, when they have to criticize a public figure, they get attacked for it. And I think a lot of people just didn't want to do it. They wanted happy talk. And sometimes I think people just wanted so much for justice to happen. We had been through so much as a country. We'd seen so much damage done by Trump. And it's terrifying. And we just refused to get our head around the fact that this wasn't working the way it was supposed to. One thing that's changed, but you asked a little while ago, you know, if my values have changed. I no longer think that justice is blind, that America is the greatest country on earth. I know firsthand that our justice system doesn't work and federal law enforcement. And I know this because of what happened to me and what's happened to others. After a while, we stopped talking about it because people just don't care. You know, we're not, it's not big, sexy, important. We don't have the big people behind us. But some of the people who were hurt the worst, we never hear about. You know, I no longer believe in justice system. I no longer believe, I think the way we elect people now is horrible. I think, you know, Citizens United has ruined this country and this unlimited money, you know, people can pocket so much of it. It's just, it's ridiculous. And we now know how horrible the Electoral College is in terms of a way to elect presidents. So I have love of country, but I don't have this sort of Pollyannish view that America is the greatest and blah, blah, blah.
So, right. You know,
and that's not cynicism. It's just being realistic and smart.
Right, sure, of course. And it's been fascinating, though, Sherry, I think, to observe this collective education that we've all been going through in terms of how an investigation works when you're looking at the subject of the investigation being an ex-president. Maybe it was a mistake to do this, but I mean, my position was that I felt the unprecedented nature of what was happening. The investigation of an ex-president required, you know, a careful process. I mean, obviously, I am unclear in terms of all of the nuts and bolts that go into an investigation like this. Like, what is required to get us to a place where we can have indictments and a trial underway when you're talking about an ex-president and just the newness of that?
Why would an ex-president be different than any other American?
That's exactly right. And that's a great point. And that's exactly what we've come to realize, and perhaps too late, that this should have proceeded as though Donald Trump were just any other citizen. And we've seen example after example after example like that play out as he's given all of this leeway that he absolutely does not deserve, all this benefit of the doubt, all this wiggle room, even from most recently Judge Mershon issuing what I thought was a kind of a weak gag order. I mean, obviously, we're talking about a different venue, but we're talking about a weak gag order, knowing Donald Trump's behavior, knowing how he would exploit the system to be able to wiggle out of this or at least delay long enough to get him to November 5th or, more importantly, January 20th of next year.
Yeah. And we've seen this, and we know that we found out about the Mar-a-Lago raid on the documents from Donald Trump. We would never have known. I don't know if they could have quietly retrieved enough of them. Would Merrick Garland have told us that, yeah. that this was going on. And so there were special considerations for him that others would not be given. I'm going to go back to the first potential impeachment. I'm going back to the Mueller report. And so many people whiffed on what their responsibilities were because we still couldn't believe or we didn't want to accept the fact that this guy was for real.
Yeah.
We kept thinking this can't be true or somebody else will deal with it. We don't want to deal with it. It could ruin my career. So we saw this, the Mueller report. All right. So Bill Barr, as we all know, he lied about it. I did the Project America Reads the Mueller report to try and reach persuadable voters who only watch Fox News, were not a part of the cult, but simply were not accessing full and accurate information. If you reach them, then you can get some of them, and close elections are won or lost in those margins. Mm-hmm. So that's what we were doing with that and airing these half-hour celebrity readings of excerpts from the Mueller report in key battleground states on local TV, because Fox News people, viewers, watch local programming. You can't force them to watch CNN. You can't force them to watch MSNBC. They're not on Twitter. They might be on Facebook. You know, it's that sort of a thing. With the Mueller report after that, there were, 10, 11 counts of obstruction of justice. Mueller came right out and said Trump can be indicted upon leaving office, but we're going to adhere to the OLC memo, which he didn't really have to do, but he did. Mm-hmm. So we're all still acting like he's just like any other just bad president or something. We still weren't accepting it. At that point, Nancy Pelosi, who I love and support, but she declined to impeach. You could say, well, the Senate wouldn't do it anyway. First of all, early on like that, I'm not so sure that's true. I think once the House blinked and they decided not to impeach, Trump knew he could push even further. Now he knew how far he could go. And that's what he's doing with these judges. It's been working for him, too. He knows he's not going to be thrown in jail for violating a gag order. He knows it. Yeah. He's going to do what he wants, like he's been doing. And there's nothing anybody's doing about it. They keep whiffing. And so by not impeaching him, by not going through that process, when they could have with the Mueller report, I think that that's when the guardrails were down. And mm-hmm. I think history will show that. And we've seen this over and over and over again. People want to half-ass it. You have lawyers that don't want to really do the job. They become afraid. We have judges that become afraid and want to just, you know, get things off the table. And now we've got an entire Republican Party of people who are afraid. Again, that establishment was not there in Congress when he first was running, but little by little, you know, the good guys are leaving, we're getting defeated, and we got this garbage coming in that's dangerous, and a lot of them are insurrectionists, and so far, Merrick Garland seems to be okay with that.
Okay, short break. Back with more Sherry Jacobus after this.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, it's Randy Rhodes, and here's what you missed. The media is failing. The media is failing terribly, terribly at letting people know that this election is not a choice between the lesser of two evils. This is an election for the character, for the democracy itself, for the rule of law itself, for the rights of people to move freely about this country or to be put in camps, the right for all people, all humans to be considered humans. This is what's on the ballot. This is where we're at. When the narrative doesn't fit, whenever the facts don't play into the narrative, like the economy is good, we've had 39 months of straight growth. Certain media outlets, they just don't talk about it. They just leave it out. They just don't report on it. And so we are failing. We're failing as a nation. Don't have time to listen to the live show? Want to hear more on your schedule? Go to randyrhoads.com and buy a stinking podcast.
Bob Seska.
All-time favorites all day long.
If he had been put on trial a year ago and convicted, would he be running today? Because, I mean, the thing that I'm always considering, Sherry, is the fact that irrespective of when the investigation and trials had begun, this would still come down to the American voters in 2024. If they felt that Donald Trump should be back in the White House, none of these trials would be relevant anymore, even the state and local ones, which he would, of course, ignore as far as his culpability in that, not to mention his participation in that if he were a sitting president. So that's my only thing is...
But they wouldn't believe him at this point. Once he's convicted, I think it would have hurt him. You have to go back and know what the chatter was with regard to big donors. They were concerned. Mm-hmm. But he's kind of survived, so they're like, well, okay. And, you know, they'll write the checks for him. Most of them will. But I think that his even parts of his base, they could have said, oh, jailing your political opponents. It's like, well, no. He probably would not have, if they'd done it earlier, he wouldn't have been able to announce a run. And he probably would not be a factor by then. You would have had a lot of people, big name Republicans, who would have cut ties with him, and this would be over. Right now, we've got Romney and Mike Pence. Of course, Romney's out, got a foot out the door. This is what they're doing. But these are people who could have done it a long time ago, and a lot more would have followed, and he would not be a factor. He'd be a thorn in our side. He would still have a hardcore, toothless MAGA base with their red hats. He would not be having rallies. He would not get this media time. He would not be getting this money. I think that while we wouldn't be rid of him per se, I don't think that he'd be a candidate. I don't think that he'd be a viable candidate. The fact that he has survived this long, I mean, I see this every day on Twitter. People say, oh, if he was guilty of anything, he would have been in prison a year ago. You know, of course, these are Elon Musk, fake blue check mark accounts.
Of course,
I just got my blue check mark back last week for some
reason. Oh, congratulations. I have not received mine yet. So
That means that I'm just better and luckier than you, Bob. Because Elon decided that I could have mine back, but you can't. I'm going to be all stuck up about that for, a week.
Oh, God. So, that stupid, stupid website. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So there's all these fake accounts, the blue check marks, and, they're just garbage.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's the cult, the people that are at the rallies, I don't think they're on Twitter. They get their information somewhere else. They're not on Truth Social. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of Facebook stuff going on. But, but the polls are still the polls, and that's we see Biden coming up. Now, I've never been. Can I talk about the polls for a second?
Yes, please do, because it's a source of great confusion and anxiety for sure.
Yeah. Well, first of all, polls don't predict elections. Polls tell you what happened last week.
Right.
And for those of us who have run campaigns and have bought polls and sat there through, the presentations by the pollsters as we analyze it, you do your polls internally that you don't want to, there's different reasons to do polls. There's the polls you do to release publicly. And first you might, like if you're running a congressional race, you might do a week of saturation radio or something to get the name ID up and some positives. Then you do the poll and you release it for good because the numbers are going to be good, even if it's just a blip. And you can raise money off that and get some good media attention and get endorsements. But polls basically tell you what you're doing right, what you're doing wrong. You look at them internally, you pick them apart, you see where you need to go, where you need to spend the money, where you need to send your candidate, that sort of thing. Where you're in trouble, where you're strong, where you're weak. It's harder to get a good poll now because of cell phones and whatnot, but it's not impossible.
Right.
So I think that the reason polls have been so off, first of all, there are good pollsters and bad pollsters. Mm-hmm. Good polls and bad polls. And a lot of the polls that we see out there are just bad polls, and there are bad pollsters. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest with you. Kellyanne Conway always had a reputation for being a bad pollster.
Shocking.
As a Republican because she would do something and tell the client or potential client what they wanted to hear.
Yeah.
So it was that sort of thing. So if you're in the business, you kind of know who you're going to hire and who you're not. So it's I think a lot of them, that we have so much, when a big issue happens, like what just happened in Arizona, on, you know, on abortion.
Yep.
When a big issue happens, that prompts people, very quickly, interested parties, to register to vote in large numbers, you know, young people. And I think when pollsters are getting their call lists, I don't think they're keeping up with these bursts in registration. And I think that is a very, very big reason why polls are so off and why Republicans are running. Like, you could have a plus seven Republican House seat, or Democrats almost should look at it as a toss-up. Or, you know, maybe plus three, plus four. And so there might be more House races, for example, in play this cycle than we think. And we've seen this happen. I don't so when you get these call lists, your voter registration list as a pollster, and you've got your room full of people doing the calls, and it takes longer to get someone on the phone. So so you've got these call lists, but if you're not updating them constantly, you're going to be missing big pockets of new registrants.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? I was thinking about this, and you mentioned Arizona, Sherry, and I have this theory, and I'm feeling more and more confident in this theory and the validity of it, that the reason Donald Trump put out that abortion video last week is because he saw internal polling that showed him getting perhaps shellacked in a bunch of swing states. Can you elaborate on the difference between the validity of external public polling versus internal polling, and whether or not my theory about Trump may have some accuracy? Or not.
Well, as I was just saying, your internal polling is different.
Okay, right.
You know, there was a reason why Paul Manafort gave Kilimnik, or basically giving it to Putin, internal campaign polling in 2016. By the way, he handed it over to him at the restaurant in the 666 building that belonged to Kushner. There's a restaurant there Russians, the Russians go to. And that breaks it down. That wasn't a public poll. That lets them know where they could prepare to go, if you believe my theory, on election night. Remember, there was ABC's Chris Vlasto was good friends with Dave Bossi, Mr. Citizens United, who was the deputy campaign manager for Trump. He was the one who introduced Trump to Steve Bannon, to Corey Lewandowski.
Yep.
You know, he and Kellyanne are joined at the hips. They're all tied in with that Mercer money.
Right.
So with the Mercers and, you know, Cambridge Analytica and all that. So there is a media consortium that does exit polling on election day. It is secret. They do it, so the media, unless it's real, real close, the media tends to know hours before it's announced who's won, all right? They have the exit polling, and exit polling tends to be pretty accurate, all right? So at 5 o'clock on election day, polls are still open, 5 o'clock Eastern, the media consortium releases the exit polling to other members of that consortium. It's still supposed to be kept secret. Chris Vlasto at 5:01 picks up the phone and calls Dave Bossi on the Trump campaign. He says, "You guys lost, and here's where," meaning which states. They take that information to Trump. He turns to Melania. He says, "We lost. Reince Priebus has it. Manafort," let's say Manafort gets it. What's Manafort going to do with that? Now, another situation we have is where there was a whistleblower who testified in a separate issue, that Karl Rove once told her that if a state is within 3 percentage points on election night, you can cheat undetected.
Holy shit.
So they know they lost that night. They knew where and what happened on that election night over the next few hours. 77,000 votes divided just the right way, precisely the right way, divided Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, gave Trump the Electoral College win. He had lost the popular vote.
Yeah.
And exit polling showed that when they got that information at 5:01 p.m. that they had lost the Electoral College. But over the course of the next few hours, they pulled out this win. Now, I think Hillary knew this, but at that point, we just didn't do those things asking for recounts. It just didn't happen.
Yeah.
I think they since have cleaned it up. Which is what, you know, and that's why Trump lost in 2020, because the pandemic had everybody doing paper ballots with mailboxes. That's why they were so blatant at the end, Bob, when they had, you know, literally Louis DeJoy was having, you know, mailboxes torn out of the ground in key Democratic neighborhoods so that people couldn't vote. Then he was just out of the blue dismantling these $2 million mail sorting machines just before the election for no good reason so that they would, yeah, I mean, they were in a panic and an absolute panic because you can't do that with paper ballots. So I think they've done a lot of work in terms of cleaning up and making it a lot cleaning up the system, you know, with the machines. But I do think this is what happened in 2016.
Do you think the votes were changed somehow through hacking the system, or how did that work?
You know, they only need to do, all you need to do is do something, you know, a couple votes per precinct that no one would notice.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't know how it's done. I'd have to look at Jenny Cohen. Is pretty good at that stuff.
Right.
And the reason it's not talked about a lot, because then people say, oh, well, that means you can do vote tampering, and that's how Biden won in 2020. Well, no.
I mean, I remember looking at the three states you mentioned, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and noticing that Jill Stein got the same number of votes that would have put Hillary Clinton over the top in those three states. So maybe there were votes moved in little dribs and drabs here and there from Hillary Clinton to Jill Stein so as to kind of take the spotlight off of Trump. Like moving the votes from Hillary to Trump upon a forensic examination would have seemed super duper hinky, obviously. But moving them from Hillary Clinton to Jill Stein, well, no one's maybe going to notice that. I don't know. It seems like.
They were divided in just the right way, which is you know, to pinpoint it that much. But, you know, for Putin to do something like that, he knows that, I think he was confident nothing would happen, because in America, we don't do that. We're not used to that. I think Hillary knew instantly what happened. And decided not to fight it, because that would just be a bloodbath for her.
Yeah.
That would have been horrible for her, and it would have looked horrible, because we just don't do that here. Because in this country, as I was saying, we are taught to believe that democracy and justice and, you know, we're just the greatest country on earth. And I think we're pretty great in a lot of ways, but it's not what people think. Like I said, our justice system, our tax system, the way we treat the poor, the way we treat minorities, the way we treat women now, the way we treat animals with the barbaric slaughter that no one sees. If you knew it, you would.
I know it. I'm right there with you on that. That's for sure.
So especially pork, you know, pigs have the mentality of a child. So that's a whole nother discussion. Mm-hmm. But that's probably the one thing which at first I thought was a negative. I'm like, no, I'd rather at this late age, at this age, be more realistic about what our country is. And it's not great.
What's your take on this? I don't know, this gray area the Republicans, especially Donald Trump, are trying to stake out on abortion. Obviously, they're still all in on a national ban. Project 2025 calls for a national ban.
Right.
But Donald Trump sees the political consideration here, much like the immigration bill that he killed, because now the idea, well, we have to make sure we win, and then we'll do whatever with the hell we want. But the messaging right now is really murky. It seems like this is not going to work out very well for Trump and the Republicans, because they're still going to be pissing off all the normals on abortion. But now they might also be pissing off some evangelicals who are pretty hard line on the issue. So what's the logic? What's the calculus behind this, Sherry?
You mean the cop out, leave it up to the states? I mean, that's been a cop out for people, you know, on both sides for decades. So that's nothing new. I don't know. I mean, Trump knows how to speak to the evangelicals so that they don't, the way our media is, everything is not just bifurcated, it's trifurcated, it's all over the place, it's all compartmentalized. So he can speak to these people so they never hear conflicting information. He knows how to do that.
Yeah.
And they will believe him. That's what they do.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's going to work out for him. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it's going to work out for a lot of the candidates.
Yeah.
But it was always sort of this thing off in the distance that maybe could happen. I don't think anybody ever thought Roe was in true jeopardy. It was one of those things they bring up every election to try and get the evangelicals because they're part of the coalition, and Republicans mm-hmm. can't win unless you have the full coalition. And so the wealthy people that just want their tax breaks and the corporations kind of hold their noses on this stuff because they're like, yeah, we know what you have to do for evangelicals or you don't get the majority and none of us get anything. So now that Roe is bent, Trump's bragging that he killed Roe, then that makes it a little bit different. It's more real.
Yeah.
And we've seen how that affects elections and what I brought up before about polling registration. Mm-hmm. So does this mean that Carrie Lake should just like almost just go home and lick her wounds now for losing in Arizona? I hope so.
Right. Yeah, me
because
too.
Because of turnout. Yeah. Because of turnout. So, you know, but I don't know. I don't know. It's a funny thing. If Trump says the right thing, see, that's the thing. If he wants to turn out his evangelical base, how is he going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
They don't care that he raped E. Jean Carroll. They don't believe it. They're not going to care about Stormy Daniels. They really don't.
Yeah.
So how does he talk to them about abortion?
I don't know.
He's saying Democrats want to kill a baby after it's born. He has to take things to make it so extreme. He has to draw a contrast between himself mm-hmm. and Democrats. And because that's harder to do when he's trying to straddle the issue, that's why he has to say they're killing babies after birth. And he has to go that far, kind of like how, and I'm not trying to change the subject here, but just give you an example of how they do this. Republicans before could always be, they could please people by being homophobic. Mm-hmm. Well, now no one cares about that. No one cares about gay marriage. In fact, most people are fine with it. So they have to up the ante. So now they're talking about, you know, drag queens and trans people, and they have to find these situations that seem new and scary and something that the evangelicals don't understand and make it as scary as gays used to be. They have to keep finding the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why then when that didn't really work, so they had to say, well, what about they're doing this with children, letting them, you know, the trans children and the surgeries. They have to keep upping the ante.
Yeah.
And so Trump will do that with the issue of abortion by claiming that Republicans will kill a baby after birth or in the birth canal. Now, remember, when he had that interview with Tim Russert all those years ago, he said he was pro-abortion right up to birth.
Mm-hmm.
But he, quote, changed his mind, I guess, so now it doesn't matter.
Shocking. Shocking yeah. that he has no core values.
I know. I'm as shocked as anybody.
I know. But how do they square the destruction of so-called babies during IVF? Because that's obviously another position that Donald Trump staked out in that video. Okay, well, I'm okay with IVF. That's fine. Evangelicals know. Evangelical voters understand that, you know, for every one IVF birth, there are maybe a dozen embryos that are destroyed in that process. How do they stake out that position? That seems super murky from an ethical or religious point of view.
It might have just been polling that told them, and they just won't talk about it, and evangelicals won't ask, to be honest. I mean, they'll focus on one or two things. I heard that it was Kellyanne that brought a poll to Trump. And I think it was probably a fake poll. And I think she did it because she didn't have to defend it, because I have a hunch that Kellyanne had all four of her children through that process.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the twins and the first were the twins and then the next two.
Mm-hmm.
And she would just prefer he stayed away from it. In fact, a lot of the people, for non-values voters who tend to vote on economic issues, so they would be older or wealthier people. And the wealthier people tend to not care about that stuff. Yeah. They want their tax breaks. They want the corporate tax breaks. They want all of that. But it would be that economic class of people who can afford IVF treatments. Mm-hmm. And this might actually get under their skin and make them have to defend it or
right.
feel bad about it or whatever. So, you know, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. So it might be something like that. That's now you're taking one of these so-called social issues, the values issues that normally would be to play to your evangelical base, but it's going to start creeping into the other class of people that you need to support you, who normally wouldn't care about that stuff, but now you're making them sit up and take notice. Their ears are going to perk up. So they have to find something to please the evangelical voters. I don't think they're going to turn against Trump on that. He simply has to up the ante and show how he is so much better than Democrats on the issue of abortion, because Democrats want to stick a scissors in the back of the head of a baby just as it's coming out the birth canal and kill it. And he will find some examples, old examples, bad examples, things that never should have happened, but maybe did happen because that's the world we live in. And he will run a campaign on that, just like he will. The Republicans will take one trans kid, or you know, one overly sexualized drag queen who did story hour, you know. And that's what they have to do. You find the thing that seems different and scary and unfamiliar. And that's how you scare the evangelicals. So they've had to move away from being just merely homophobic and making them afraid of gays, because, well, they're not afraid of gays anymore. And so again, you have to make it more and more extreme. It's like you know, they become numb to that, so they have to keep shocking them and scaring them.
Yeah. Was it the Kellyanne poll that she gave to Donald Trump? Was that the inciting incident that led to that video last week that he made? Is that a different thing? Or two different things?
I have no idea. Okay. I think that for IVF it would have been a completely different situation.
Okay.
For me, if I'm just being a soulless advisor to someone, I would be looking at what I just laid out to say, okay, we are now pulling in a part of our coalition who wouldn't care about this before because they're a part of the coalition for economic and tax reasons and whatever. And now you're making them care about the stuff that you're using to play to the evangelicals. And so we need to factor that in and see if it's worth it. Is there another way to appeal to evangelicals? You know, that sort of thing. You just sort of coldly and callously and soullessly weigh it that way. Because that's what we do.
So how are you doing health-wise, Sherry?
We're always concerned about well, you. Yeah. Thank you. I had cancer, as you guys know. Mm-hmm. And a little over 2 weeks ago, I had my full day at Johns Hopkins where I poked and prodded and IVs and CTs and sacrificing blood and all that kind of stuff. And then we pour over all this stuff. And for the first time since I ended treatment in the summer of 2021, my white blood cell count is in the normal range.
Oh, congratulations. That's so great to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of the internal damage from radiation seems to be smoothing out a little bit in one area. And that's due to physical therapy, which is basically yoga.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So do you still get immensely stressed out and just riddled with anxiety when you know you have to go to Johns Hopkins and get checked out? Is that a point of stress, or do you feel pretty confident in your health at this point?
You get a little bit of the scanxiety, and it's always a relief. But the longer we go, the longer I'm in remission, then the longer I know I'll stay in remission. Mm-hmm. And so we start spacing out the scans and the other tests. There are certain tests that I have to do all the time, and this will go on for the rest of my life. The main thing is I'll be living with mostly the damage from radiation. It does things to your bones and, you know, and that sort of thing. And, but I'm alive, and
With all this stress between politics and the retribution that was inflicted upon you by Donald Trump and his minion, and then cancer, are you finding ways to distract yourself from all that shit? We talked about this initially, but do you find things that you enjoy that make you happy in spite of all of the shitstorm that you have to deal with?
Well, as I mentioned, there hasn't been a lot of help, so wondering if I'll ever get my career back. So it's about making a living and trying to find a way to move forward when you know, at this age and this stage in life, and some of the stuff that's out there and you know, even people who are sympathetic, they just don't want to get near it. And I think that's happened with a lot of people once Trump, like the TV networks, they know what Trump did to me was bullshit.
Right.
But if they were to start having me back on, that would be an admission that they were doing his bidding. So it's just a lot easier and more convenient to sweep it under the rug and pretend I never existed. You know, you're not on TV. People tend to forget about you. So it's unfortunately it's that sort of thing. So, and that's what I meant by when Trump decides to ruin you and cancel you, you are ruined. You are canceled. There are some exceptions. If somebody comes and picks you up and dusts you off and tries to help you out, you know, that happened with E. Jean Carroll and that sort of thing. But other than that, it's pretty much done. And, mm-hmm. and that's unfortunate and sad. And I don't have a magic formula. I haven't picked the lock on that one yet. So in terms of, so that's the main thing.
Yeah.
Now that I'm healthy, it's about, okay, how do I do this, you know?
Yeah, are you the sort of person that can find a reason to jump out of bed in the morning and be at least somewhat hopeful for the day? I mean, do you have a positive outlook generally?
Depends on the day.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, for that 4 years, I was just completely on the edge of my seat because I thought every morning I'd wake up like, is today the day? Is there going to be a mushroom cloud today? Is that what's going to happen? That's what I felt like. I just had this ongoing sense of imminent doom. And it's really difficult to find a reason to put a smile on your face in the morning and proceed about your work when you know that there's, you know, an anvil dangling by dental floss over your head, you know? So,
yeah. Well, I felt like that in 2016, and so I was thinking, I got to get out of New York. I'm not safe here. And I would get up in the morning, put my feet on the ground, and then I would remember everything that was happening to me, and the catfishing and the hacking and the threats and what these people had done to me, and just being defamed and kicked off TV after 17 years and thousands of appearances. And that was kind of how I promoted my consulting.
Yeah.
Just not being able to believe what had happened to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, so alone in it. Now, since then, the whole country has had something happen, but not their livelihood taken away from them, their reputation, and that sort of thing. And nobody, you know, it's just, and like I said, there are people who lost their careers because of Trump, and there are other people who have made their careers because of Trump. And that's a function of this just going on for way, way, way too long. But to be made whole again, you know, that would certainly make me happy. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So we'll see if he loses, and if there's just some accountability, you know, maybe that's when I decide to just go move somewhere to a tropical island and paint seashells to sell to tourists and just go offline, unplug. Right. And go grow old with the natives or something.
Yeah, let us know when you're planning to do that, because we may join you. Pack our bags.
Come join me in my hut.
Yeah. Are you still working with Jeffrey Grammer? Is that still a thing?
Jeffrey Grammer suspended his campaign a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, no.
Well, we reached different points. There was one or two people that he was comfortable with that, he didn't really see a path without putting a lot of money into it. So he endorsed April Delaney. And she's the wife of the former Congressman John Delaney. He also went and ran for president, if you recall.
Yeah.
So that's what we're doing there. But yeah, so Jeffrey Grammer was a Democratic candidate running for Congress in the 6th District of Maryland, which is my home district.
Mine too.
But I had always worked as a Republican, so this was my first consulting gig as a Democrat. And I'm very grateful to him that he gave me that opportunity.
Well, you're in the right state for consulting with Democrats, for sure. So that's good. But,
well, from your lips to God's ears.
Right. Well, Sherry, I'm so glad you're around. You're one of the good ones. And the three of us are going to have to get together and have dinner soon.
We got to do that.
Yeah, meet somewhere halfway between us.
Yeah, we're all kind of near each other. Now, Kimberly and I did.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it'd have to be one including me. You know.
Okay. Yeah, we can bring you along.
Good. I'll just wedge myself into the process.
I'll talk to my people. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much. How can people find you on social media, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, find me on Twitter at Sherry Jacobus, CHERIJACOBUS. And I have a podcast on Patreon, which you have been on.
Yes.
Politics with Sherry Jacobus. You can find me there. I'm also on Threads.
What's the address for the Patreon page? Patreon.com/... Sherry Jacobus?
I guess it might be. Actually, if you go to
sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot about that.
Yeah. I know. If you just, I have a link, I think, in my bio on Twitter. It's Politics with Sherry Jacobus, and I put clips up often on Twitter, so you can find it there. And so that's what I do. And on Threads, it's Sherry Jacobus 1. You have to have the number 1 up there because somebody else says Sherry Jacobus.
Bastards.
But I'm still on Twitter. Yeah. I complain about it.
Me too.
But I'm still there.
We'll see the light one of these days in terms of the shithole website that we still visit every damn day, spend way too much time on. Well, it was great talking to you, Sherry. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you, too.
We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Look on over yonder. I see a new day marching in. With all the weight that we've been under, yeah, we're gonna rise up again. So here's to all the people left scattered. Just remember.